I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The Coalition of the Willing is about to bid farewell to a couple of nations which are no longer willing to support the U.S. occupation of Iraq. Spain and Honduras say they'll be packing their kit and leaving the standoff in southern Iraq to others. The departure of the two is notable more for its symbolic importance than any effect on the military campaign. That's principally because the departure is prompting other coalition members to ask themselves why they are there. Doubts about the strength of the coalition are compounded by the recent number of hostage incidents and attacks on foreigners. A number of countries have pulled all their people out of Iraq. This hour, we'll check in on what other nations are saying. We'd like to hear from you as well, as long as the U.S. has such overwhelming control of Iraq. Does the coalition really matter? Is it important to you that Polish and British and Albanian and Ukrainian soldiers are a part of the operations in Iraq? Is this the time when the U.S. needs to give more decision-making power to the United Nations? Or would the U.N. make a bad situation even worse? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're going to start today with the weekend announcement from the new Spanish Prime Minister that Spain will leave Iraq as soon as possible. Dan Trotta is joining us on the line from Madrid, Spain. He's a correspondent with Reuters there. Hi, Dan.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Did the announcement catch people in Spain as much as a surprise as it did here?
I think it did in the sense that it came so soon after Zapatero took office. All along they had been talking about this June 30th deadline that Spain wanted the UN to take control militarily and politically by this date, which is also the date of for handover of sovereignty to the Iraqis. And so I think the impression that was left with most people was that Spain would work very hard to try to secure a UN Security Council resolution that would be acceptable to them before that date. What the Prime Minister came out and said was that after consultations with numerous world leaders and UN leaders, they came to the conclusion that that was just impossible. There was no way there was going to be any kind of resolution that would meet the Spanish conditions. And so they decided at the very outset of their government to clear the air, to not let themselves get bogged down with this, and just go ahead and take the decision to bring them home.
Was it also a good political move in local terms? I mean, given the number of people in Spain who have questioned the involvement with the coalition all along?
You can certainly make that argument. I think that that whole issue played a factor in Zapatero being elected in the first place. Keep in mind that Spanish popular opinion was overwhelmingly against the war ahead of time. They were not pleased to see their former prime minister playing such a protagonist role in the build-up to the war. As you recall, José María Aznar was a very firm supporter of George Bush. He was held up as one of the examples of a European leader who was on board to show that there was some transatlantic unity. And Aznar, of course, was also a key player in the summit at the Azores Islands off of Portugal, just in the run-up to the war, in which Bush, Blair, and Aznar appeared to set the final plans, as it were, before the war began. Now that particular issue has been very controversial in Spain because the Spanish, as I say, were against it, and so the so-called picture of the Azores, the official photograph of that summit meeting, became emblematic of how Aznar had totally thrown himself into the Bush-Blair camp on the Iraq issue, again, when massive street demonstrations and public opinion showed that the people were against it.
I wonder if we can, Dan, just look ahead here. We understand that President Bush had some harsh words for the new Spanish Prime Minister Zapatero, and Colin Powell, actually speaking a little bit earlier, was asked about the decision of the Spanish government to pull out even earlier than expected from Iraq.
We're disappointed because we're in the middle of an active campaign and suddenly troops are being withdrawn. I'm pleased, though, that so many of our other coalition partners have stood up in the last 24 to 48 hours to say they are staying the course.
And also, Dan, the new foreign minister, new Spanish foreign minister, Morotinos, is in Washington tomorrow to meet with Colin Powell. Is he due for a spanking when he arrives?
Well, you know, he did have a conversation with Powell on Sunday, in which Powell, of course, expressed his his displeasure. The thing is, the Spanish aren't looking at it that way. They're saying that that the U.S. is still a friend, as of course as well as an ally, and that basically they just reserve the right to disagree on this issue, and it was a matter of principle for them. The Spanish also say that they are not expecting any sort of economic backlash similar to what the French experienced last year with the boycotts and whatnot against France for its withholding its support of the war. So at least from this point of view, that's not likely to be the case. I mean, Spain is still a member of NATO and seen as a friend and an ally in Europe. So it's hard to say exactly what the diplomatic fallout will be from this.
Dan, I want to thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Dan Trotta is a Reuters correspondent based in Madrid. Joining us for the balance of the hour, Jeremy Shapiro. He is Associate Director of the Brookings Institution Center on the United States and Europe, co-author of a new book, Allies at War, America, Europe, and the Crisis over Iraq. Jeremy Shapiro, nice to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
Were you also surprised at the swiftness of the Spanish decision to pull out of Iraq?
I was surprised, essentially for the reasons that were just said. The election promises that Zapatero had made were essentially that if the United Nations participation wasn't created in some form by June 30th, he would withdraw his troops. The diplomacy, not just for this reason, but for other reasons as well, was actually moving in that direction. His demands were quite possibly being in the process of being satisfied,
right.
And yet he preempted them by withdrawing the troops now and saying that his demands could never be satisfied. It's a little bit difficult to assess from the outside because he never really laid down precisely what he wanted in terms of UN participation, but it was most people's view that the diplomacy was moving in the direction that he had asked.
Let's bring one more voice into the conversation here. Piero Benetazzo has been listening along. He's one of the founders of the Rome newspaper, La Repubblica, now a freelance writer living in Rome. Piero, nice to have you back on The Connection.
Thank you very much.
And tell me how people in Italy are watching this move by the Spanish to leave the coalition. Italy has a very large contingent of forces in Iraq now. Any wavering there?
No, I wouldn't say any wavering, but certainly a sense of shock. A sense of shock even at popular level, because we do have a lot of soldiers down there, and people think that the move of Zapatero may put them in danger. And moreover, you know, in Italy, which is Italians, who are well known for having a very weak sense of the state, suddenly they have discovered a strange national pride, not only for the soldier being there, but the soldier who fight. Even this, the case of this hostage who was killed. He was killed, according to the newspaper, like a hero, because he said to the killer, "I show you how an Italian can die." You know, such an incredible sentence. Nobody knows whether he really said that or not. But indeed, the need to create a legend, to create a hero, is very strong. Probably it helped, it served to cover up some kind of uncertainty, some kind of new fear. But certainly the move of Zapatero has not encountered any kind of support, not even among the opposition. One of the leader of the opposition criticized it as unilateral, a move that could put in danger not only the situation in Iraq, but also an attempt of the European to form a new kind of position, which would prepare a new resolution of the United Nations.
Can I ask you, Piero, in Italy, when we hear Prime Minister Berlusconi speaking in strong words that Italy will stand with the United States, is that Berlusconi the leader standing beside Bush the leader, or is that Italy standing beside the United States? Is he speaking for the people when he does that?
Well, I don't think he speaks for the people. You know very well Italy was theater of a very strong peace movement, probably one of the strongest in Europe, also supported not only from the left, but also from the Catholic Church, from the Vatican. And now what is very strange, that there are no people on the street anymore. He speaks in this sense for his policy, first of all, but probably he also speaks because he cannot do anything else than that. I don't think he can change his position now. I don't think he can have a different, weaker position. I think he is only hoping that the new A resolution of the United Nations, which is now in discussion, will help him to have a rather less isolated position in Europe, because he feels somehow isolated. In this sense, he's negotiating with the opposition. And as I told you, part of the opposition is certainly helping him and want to the United Nations to have a major role and want to have a resolution which will help also the United States to accept this new role of the United Nations.
Piero, just
and so in this sense, I think he is negotiating with the opposition. If he has to be strong, because if you are weak in this situation, certainly you give in to terrorists and terrorists may attack you. And we are waiting for what is going to happen.
So when you say that the move of the Spanish to pull out of Iraq has people in Italy worrying about danger, you're talking about perhaps a repeat of the Madrid bombing if terrorists would feel that's all it would take to force Italian troops then to leave the coalition.
Yes, they are afraid of what has happened in Madrid. But I think today I was in a square in Rome and I heard normal people, really normal people on the market, criticizing Zapatero. Because, as I told you, of this fear, the fear that this may endanger even more the Italian soldier. But I think that the Madrid, the so-called 311, as has been called here, has completely changed the position, you know, in Europe. For the first time after decades, the terrorist has hit Europe. An old policy of, how you call it, of negotiation,
yeah.
Silent negotiation, with the extremist has completely collapsed. You have to you have to take into consideration that for decades, none of the European target had ever been hit before Madrid by terrorists, except in France in certain cases, because the agreement was basically that you do not hit our target and we let you accommodate, you let you have your logistical structure in Europe. This has been now completely broken, and so people don't know what is going to happen. Meanwhile, what is happening in Iraq is also worrying a lot the European country. They understood that they cannot really let the United States to fail in this operation, because if the United States should fail, then also European will pay a much higher price, also because of the large Islamic community they have inside their countries. And so you have, first of all, you can see a new trend in Berlin, for instance, or in Paris even, much more flexible toward the United States. Berlin has signed in Washington a joint pledge of action in the Middle East called the German-American Alliance for the 21st Century. And the other day in Luxembourg, the meeting of the European Foreign Ministry completely avoid to antagonize the United States on this very hot issue of
Piero,
the Middle
East. Piero, I have to interrupt you here. We're going to take a break. I want to thank you for being with us on the program today.
Thank you very much.
Piero Benetazzo is one of the founders of La Repubblica, the Rome newspaper, now a freelance writer in Rome. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. So a number of different ways that the coalition is being regarded by some states with a reflection on the recent hostage-taking and terrorist activity, a chance to stand more firmly with the United States, by others, an opportunity to take their leave. What are your thoughts about the state of the coalition and how it affects the occupation in Iraq? Our number is 1-800-423-TALK. When we come back after the break, The View from Asia, also more with Jeremy Shapiro, who's Associate Director of the Brookings. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio News. Just this morning that Honduras has decided to pull out of the Coalition of the Willing in Iraq. They joined their Spanish colleagues as the second country in 3 days to say that they no longer want to participate in the activity in Iraq. This hour we're talking about the state of the coalition, how different countries are looking at it. Jeremy Shapiro is with us. He's Associate Director of the Brookings Institution Center on the United States and Europe. And Jeremy, let me just get your reflections on what we are hearing from Piero Benetazzo there, that in fact the recent events may in fact have stiffened the spine of some members of the coalition.
That's quite possible. I think it's very true that each country receives this in its own political context. There is something, however, particularly in Europe, that unites all the countries, which is that The governments that supported Bush in Iraq and supported the United States in Iraq did so against the strong will of their people. And that's not a situation which is very easy to sustain in a democracy when you're having frequent elections, as they often do in Europe. And so what we're seeing is that the coalition was very broad, but it wasn't very deep. And so when there are setbacks, when violence breaks out, when it appears that the United States isn't doing very well, countries are very quick to jump away, to separate themselves from the United States.
I take, though, from the two reports that we had earlier that there's a sense of considerable unease in Europe. You have now the Spanish wondering whether or not they'll be punished in the same way that the Germans and the French were a year and a few months ago, and Piero talking about Italian concerns, and all of it underneath this sort of cover of what are we as Europe? Where are we? Are we standing together? Are we falling apart?
I think actually to some degree the concern in Europe is over the United States. There is a lot of concern that U.S. policy is to some degree out of control, and that especially after September 11th, the United States, having created a very impressive and forceful military, kind of arrogated it to itself both the right and the capacity to do nearly anything that it wanted, and really stopped consulting with its allies and stopped considering what the wider implications of some military moves would be. And that kind of lack of predictability in U.S. policy, which had been a hallmark of U.S. policy for many years, has really worried Europeans. Of course, it's interacted with the various domestic scenes, as we've seen. Mm-hmm. But that continues to worry them because, quite frankly, they're not entirely clear on where the United States will go next. They're not entirely clear on what the United States' reaction to greater problems in Iraq will be, and they're not clear on what the U.S. reaction even to success in Iraq would be, where the United States might go next. And that is something that makes them very uncomfortable because they're quite aware that they live in a U.S.-ordered world.
I do want to talk a little bit further about allies and alliances later in the program, but I'd like to bring Rob Gifford in now. Our listeners will know Rob as Beijing correspondent for NPR, and he's joining us on the line from Beijing. Hi, Rob.
Hi, Dick.
You've been on the road lately, Japan, South Korea, China, checking in with countries there. Can you give us a bit of a walkthrough? Let's start with Japan. There were hostages being held there. The Japanese were very jumpy about that. What was the effect of that just a few days ago on Japan's determination to remain a part of the coalition?
Well, I think the hostages were a major part of it. You have to remember, Japan has lived in this sort of pacifist bubble for the last 60 years since World War II. And so it's a big shock for their citizens to be kidnapped like that in Iraq. And it's part of a bigger issue of Japan, as some people there put it, becoming a normal country. Mr. Koizumi, the prime minister, wants to get the troops out into the world, wants to get into peacekeeping, wants to create this so-called normal country. And that is really where the debate centers at the moment, between people who say, no, we're quite happy how we are with this mm-hmm. pacifist constitution, which doesn't allow this, and those who say, look, come on, we do want to be a normal country, and that involves taking some risks.
And is Koizumi way out in front of the public there, as Jeremy was saying, is the risk for European leaders?
I think he's got a lot of support, a certain amount of support, partly because he's seen as quite tough. He's quite popular in Japan, and he's seen, I think there is a younger generation coming through that supports this reshaping of Japanese identity. And there's one other crucial issue here, which also applies to South Korea, and that is Japan and South Korea's own backyard, and that is North Korea. Iraq is actually a long, long way away from here, from Northeast Asia. But North Korea is not. North Korea is a big problem. And there is a feeling in Japan and South Korea that if those two countries cooperate with the United States on Iraq, then they will get the full support of the United States in trying to deal with North Korea, which, after all, has been launching missiles over the Japanese mainland, has been threatening all sorts of things, and is developing this nuclear weapons program, which worries the South Koreans and the Japanese.
Now, Now, I remember, I think it was your reporting about the South Korean election last year when this younger generation that you're describing were among the first in South Korea to start questioning the strength and power of the United States and wondering whether or not South Korea should remain as close to the USA as it had over the years. When we take a look at South Korea and its involvement in the coalition, any fracturing, any weakening there?
Well, I think there are some minor fractures there, but I think they are not that serious yet. I think this is all part of the, again, the reshaping of South Korean identity in this post-Cold War world. A lot of young people don't remember the Korean War. They don't remember how America came to the rescue of South Korea and saved it from communism, basically. So these people, they want to assert South Korean identity, and they're saying, why on earth should we just be slaves to American foreign policy in the Middle East? And that is a growing trend. But as I say, I think there are these overarching geopolitical issues that trump that trend and say, look, basically, we're going in. We are supporting. We've got a 60-year alliance here with the United States. And for the moment, at least, I think that is the main issue here. And that's taken over from this growing anti-Americanism.
All right. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about the state of the coalition and looking at reactions and assessments from right around the world. We're interested in your thoughts about the importance of holding it together. We're going to take our first call from Amherst, New Hampshire, and Scott's joining us. Hi, Scott.
Howdy.
Thanks for calling. What do you think?
The point I wanted to make is there's a episode of The Simpsons in which Homer gets his arm caught in a soda vending machine. And when the rescue workers come to help him, it's finally realized that until he lets go of the can of Coke, he'll never get his arm back out of the machine. And the point I'm trying to make is that we say we're there to bring democracy, but in fact, if you read the neoconservatives, they gloat over the possibility of setting Iraqi policy, writing the Constitution, and determining, you know, the role in OPEC and how they'll feel about the PLO, and maybe noble things like the right of women to be educated. But we're not actually interested in internationalizing it, in giving political control to the UN, and letting Iraqis freely choose the government of their own choosing.
So what you're saying is that until the United States makes some kind of dramatic turnaround, and a public one at that, about what its intentions are in Iraq, then members of the coalition are going to remain shaky, wondering when the U.S. will let go of the can of Coke. Is that the point you're making?
That's the point I'm making, that the... You know, the tension is not over just the humiliation of checkpoints, but that we're there to dictate policy.
And Jeremy,
until we actually let go of that dream that we can set up a country of our liking. It's the same dream that we have many places, that we can support a paramilitary organization. You know, in
let me just keep it in Iraq for the time being, if I can, Scott. Thanks for your call, and Jeremy, maybe I can get you to answer Scott's notion of the situation. The United States has been making, you know, warm overtures towards the UN, towards the UN envoy Lakhdar Brahimi, and almost as much as they possibly could for this administration. Is that enough, or does there need to be more?
I'm not really sure whether it's enough or yet. We'll see. I think that using his analogy, though, they already have sort of let go of the can of Coke. The can of Coke was not so much the idea that we could recreate Iraq in our own image. I don't think anybody ever really thought that. The can of Coke was more that we could do it. We could do whatever needed to be done in Iraq by ourselves, and really, regardless of what U.S. motives really were, it's become abundantly obvious, I think, even to the Bush administration, that whatever needs to be done in Iraq, we cannot do it alone. We need the legitimacy of the international community, and we need that legitimacy for several reasons. One is troops on the ground, but that's really not even the biggest reason. The biggest reason is to maintain domestic support at home, to convince ourselves that this is something that is worth doing and that is something we should be doing, mm-hmm. And to avoid the idea that it's that this is a struggle for oil or a struggle for control of the Persian Gulf or something like that.
I wonder if I can bring Rob back in here, Rob, because the news today, of course, is that There is this push to get a new UN resolution written. The new British ambassador to the UN is talking about a resolution that would recognize the end of occupation, bless the new interim government, authorize a continuing international military force. And, of course, China is a permanent member on a Security Council that would have to give its blessing to something like that. That's your home base. You've been watching China's response to this. China, of course, not a part of the coalition, but a very influential member. And what are you seeing there in Beijing?
Well, I think this is part of Beijing's bigger strategy with Afghanistan and with Iraq. Those two countries don't affect China too directly, although there is a growing reliance on Middle Eastern oil. Generally speaking, the Chinese don't see it's worth annoying the Americans enough to veto any resolution that the Americans might want. And we saw that with the initial to and fro in the Security Council last year before the war in Iraq. The Chinese are using this time to basically buy brownie points with the government in Washington, with the US government, because they, for 10 years, basically, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, were shaping up to be the post-Cold War enemy. And then 9/11 happened, and suddenly the enemy was revealed, and it wasn't them. And I think they're rather delighted by that, and they don't want to have a bust-up with Washington, and so they want to stay on side, on board with the Bush administration. They'll make a few hits at the Bush administration.
Well, I was going to say, there's got to be a little bit of glee that they're not actually drawn into this.
There is, of course, and there's no chance that they're going to be drawn into it. Underneath, they think it's appalling. They think they're totally shocked that the United States has invaded Iraq, and they're worried that perhaps in future this could set a precedent for the U.S. wanting to do something like that with territories like Tibet or Taiwan that China cares greatly about. But in the end, they want to focus on economic modernization. They wasted 30 years under Chairman Mao, so they got a lot of catch-up to do. And this is allowing them a bit of breathing space where they're not having to be back and forth about human rights, about, sure, there's trade issues, there's a few issues going on, but I think they are happy to go along and not annoy Washington too much because they're able to free ride a little bit and score some brownie points with Washington that they may be able to cash in those chips later on.
Rob, good to have you with us.
Thanks very much, Dave.
Rob Gifford is Beijing correspondent for NPR. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. To Concord, Massachusetts now, Mike's with us. Hi, Mike. Thanks for calling.
Hi. The Spanish made a commitment to stand with us on a battlefield. And even if it was only 1,400 troops, in the middle of an active battle, the Spanish people, if you're not willing to feel that their prime minister necessarily represents them, let's talk about the Spanish people. The Spanish people turned their back on our boys and girls and walked off the battlefield. And while they walked off, they said, oh, but look, we still want to be your friends. Will there be retaliation? There better be some retaliation against the Spanish. Those are our blood.
And the commitment that Mike, that you're describing that came from Prime Minister Aznar is one that unquestionably, in your mind, had to be honored by the government that came after him.
Last time I looked, Spain was a democracy, and their governments represent the people. So the people of Spain made a commitment at some point in time in the past, and now they're reneging on it. It doesn't matter that the government changed. The people of Spain, that's who they speak to. It's a democracy, just like we are.
And Jeremy Shapiro, it's an interesting way that Mike chooses to put it. I think when we look at drawing comparisons to the French reluctance to enter the war, the German decision to criticize the U.S. for entering the war, Mike says you don't cut and run in the middle of a battle. Has he got a point here?
He does have a point, although I would warn him to look at the commitment that Spain made, which was not open-ended. In fact, they quite distinctly said that they were participating in peacekeeping operations and not in peace enforcement. And one of the reasons that the Spanish were uncomfortable with the mission as it had become is because of some of the recent operations in Fallujah had made them feel that the United States had mischaracterized the mission to them. Even having said that, though, I think there's a point here. But it goes to some degree to the heart of how you manage an alliance. You really, it would be wonderful if everybody just kind of honored commitments like that. But the history of alliances doesn't look like that. The history of alliances is countries getting together to operate in their common interest. And when it ceases to be in their common interest, they stop operating together.
You've made a comparison in the past to this alliance as something closer to the image of the Warsaw Pact, formed, I think, in the mid-50s on the strength of the Soviet Union bullying along Eastern European countries to be a part of that.
I wouldn't want to draw that comparison too strongly, but I think that there's something to that. The Warsaw Pact was based essentially on Soviet power. Countries followed the Warsaw Pact line because they had to, and for a long time, Soviet power was big enough that they were willing to do that. This coalition that was built in Iraq, in great contrast to the coalitions that the United States had built in the past, was sort of built on this Soviet model. They simply said to these countries, we are very powerful, we are going to do this, and you pretty much have to follow us, or at worst, stand aside.
Do the British stand as an exception to that comparison, or no?
I don't think they stand as a big exception. Tony Blair as well committed his country against the will of his people, and I think there's some evidence against his own judgment, although he certainly denies that. And he is, if you watch a prime minister's questions, you see outrage from even members of the prime minister's own party that he was willing to go to war in this fashion. And it's very interesting to watch the diplomacy leading up to the war, which we document in the book. There are times when right before the war when the British were kind of expressing a degree of reluctance, or at least a desire to go for a second resolution. And the message essentially came back from Washington, you know, if you're not with us, we can do this alone. And
I'm going to stop you there, Jeremy, because we have to take a short break. We'll come back and continue the conversation. The book that Jeremy is referring to is a new one that he is a co-author of called Allies at War, America, Europe, and the Crisis Over Iraq. He wrote that with Philip Gordon. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. What are the American alternatives now when it comes to assessing the strength of the coalition? Is it time to strong-arm the allies or move to the UN or simply allow people to make the decisions based on their own national interests? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. What is the value of coalitions such as the one the United States leads in Iraq now? What's the weight or the legitimacy that comes from those? And what difference does it make when countries raise questions or, in fact, pull out of those coalitions? We'd like to hear from you. We're at 1-800-423-TALK. I'm going to take our next call from Somerville, Massachusetts. Now, Angel is joining us. Hi, Angel.
Good morning. And thank you for the opportunity to express my view around the pullout of the troops from Iraq. And I like to say that it started with Spain. I think the Spanish people give a mandate to the new prime minister to pull out, and I think it's is correct. It's a democratic to follow what the people will mandate. And secondly, I'm very strongly happy that Honduras have announced that they're going to pull out the troops, because Honduras is a small country, and basically was conditionally, was forced, almost forced to really send a few troops over there. And I think it's very unfair to the international community.
Angel, are you from Honduras originally?
Originally, I'm from Honduras.
And did you get the feeling that the Honduras government simply joined the coalition because it wanted to make good with Washington?
Yes. I think that's the primary reason why they were manipulated to look like that they are part of the a big coalition, which in reality that coalition was weak.
Manipulated is a pretty strong word there, Angel. I mean, what do you mean they were manipulated to join the join the coalition?
Because Honduras always has been basically a puppet of the U.S. government.
Right.
If you remember all the time of the war in Central America, it was in Honduras that Negro Ponte helped to organize the Contra-Revolution, where create enormous tragedy for the Honduran and Central Americans, because a lot of people were killed. A lot of people, the economy suffered. It still suffers.
So this is a statement of Honduran nationalism to say, you know, we only have 370 soldiers in Iraq, but you know what? We're leaving. Do you see that as a statement of Honduran nationalism?
I think that Honduras, at this point, the president has made the right choice, because the Congress of Honduras, they don't see the point to continue having those troops there. Part of the economy of Honduras is very weak, and I don't think that's going to help. And in any event, I don't think Honduras get any benefits to having troops in Iraq.
Angel, I want to thank you very much for your call. It's nice to have you on the program. Let me go to Jeremy. And Jeremy, I don't know what kind of a survey you're able to keep here, but there seems to be some nervousness in Washington, even at the administration level, about the number of other countries which could come to a similar conclusion like this. If there are members of the coalition who had their arms twisted to join, or if there are other nations thinking of quitting, I mean, do we know? Are there two, three, seven others who are reassessing it at this moment?
Well, there are 33 members in the coalition, so it's a little bit hard to say what some of the smaller countries are doing. I think that it's clear that for most of the governments, they've sort of staked their reputation on this, on being part of the coalition. What we heard in Italy is typical of Berlusconi's government is never going to withdraw the Italian troops. But if the if governments change, then we could see further withdrawals. And many of these governments are quite vulnerable. There's a series of elections coming up, and opposition leaders in many countries, in countries like Australia, traditionally the most solid American ally in the world, in New Zealand, in Italy itself, actually, in Poland, and in even to some degree in Britain, have talked about what they would do if they were in power and how they would take a different view of the alliance, and that might involve withdrawals of troops.
Is the U.S. further weakened by the fact that it never really bothered us to bring Russia in, to bring China in, to bring Turkey in, the big countries which might have been, sort of might have given it the sort of international veneer that people question today?
I think the difference is less Russia and China than the European countries whom we've traditionally relied on for legitimacy. It's interesting to compare the Kosovo operation in 1999 with the Iraq War last year. In Kosovo, there was also no UN Security Council mandate because Russia would not allow it. But after very careful and hard diplomacy, all of the European democracies were on board.
Well, that was a NATO operation. That was one of the reasons why it succeeded, right?
Right, because it was and therefore it was able to be a NATO operation because all the Europeans were on board, and there was very little question about its legitimacy, even though the Russians and the Chinese were not on board. One of the places that legitimacy comes from for operations like this is not just which country, it's not just the number of countries, but it's specifically which countries. And we, the international community is made up of particularly very strong democracies. And the views of those democracies are viewed as somehow more legitimate in total than countries like Russia and China. So if we had had the Frances and the Germanys and truly the Spains and the Italys and other countries like that on board for this operation, that probably would have been enough. But we didn't even do that.
Interesting just to think that here we are more than a year after those conversations were taking place. And in effect, what we're saying is that the U.S. continues to pay the price for its decision to move without those. I want to move ahead, if you don't mind. We've got a number of people who want to join us on the phone. Let me go to Halifax, Virginia next. And Dave's with us. Hi, Dave. Thanks for calling.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for letting my call come in. No, I just wanted to make the comment, put aside the political differences. But, you know, so often the United States is moving around the world helping these people out, be it humanitarian, with aid, with protection. And I'll think back to what the gentleman just said about Honduras. I mean, when the United States started, we weren't a great superpower, but we were small but defended ourselves. And I think some of these other countries, you know, are going to have to stand up and remember what we're doing for other countries and peoples around the world by just the genuine kindness and, I think, concern for life that we as Americans have. And I just wish that would become more of a part of the discussion of, you know, what we've done for these other people.
Why do you suppose, Dave, that doesn't end up being a larger part of the conversation? I mean, I take your point quite seriously, and yet what we hear more than anything else is, you know, criticism from African countries, from Central American countries, from South American countries, who all have pieces of history that they quarrel with the United States over.
Well, I understand that, but again, I think there's also another motive behind a lot of these countries is I think everybody would like the U.S. dollars and what other aid to come to them. So I think in some ways there may be a selfish position knowing that, you know, we're going to be in the nature that we are as a country. We're going to help other people out even when they slap us in the face. And I'm just reminded, if you go back to the first Gulf War and you look at those Marines and they've been bombing one of these bunkers and for days, and these Iraqis come up with a white flag and our Marines go up to these guys and are sitting there giving them their rations, their water, giving them care there in the middle of the desert. I don't think many other countries would have treated our soldiers the same way. So, you know, in the midst of an ugly war, we were still, you know, rise above the occasion because of our concern for human life, I think. So, granted,
I think that's a great point, and I want to turn it to Jeremy Shapiro because I suspect, as Dave points out, that there's this kind of questioning among the administration that for you know, all that the United States did for the European countries in the Second World War, none of the alliance goodwill that was built over the past 50 or 60 years seems to count for quite as much as they might have thought it would.
Well, it counts for something, but it's certainly true. I mean, I would take the caller's point that the United States has a history which it can really be proud of, and it's a history which isn't matched by many other countries, or any, perhaps. Nonetheless, the United States has also done some bad things in its history. And the other countries, quite simply, for better or for worse, for whether it's true or not, don't view us in the way that the caller expressed it. They view us like any other country, as a country which is out to protect its own interests. We had built up, I think, over the past 50 or 60 years, a certain reservoir of goodwill, particularly in Europe, because of the role we had played after World War II and in World War II. But that was not infinite, and it has to some degree been squandered because we kind of took it for granted. We almost based our foreign policy on gratitude, and gratitude is not a foreign policy.
But fascinating to see how quickly that goodwill can be either lost or squandered, depending on how you want to look at it.
Yeah, it can go very quickly, but it's interesting to note that most of these countries did go with us to Iraq. And none of them, I think, went with us to Iraq because they thought going to Iraq was a good idea. They went because America told them that they should go. And that was, believe it or not, enough to do, despite that in many countries they were facing opposition from 90% of their
right.
population. So that shows the power of gratitude. But if you use that to, if you don't pay enough attention to maintaining that, it does go away.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. And take another call from Arlington, Massachusetts. Tayaba's with us. Hi, Tayaba.
Hi. I have a different question, but I can't help but comment on this previous caller's concern about all the good that the United States has done, and that goes unacknowledged. I think the problem is that most of us in this country don't hear about the damage that the United States has done, and a lot of it has been far reaching than the good. And I think that's why the population is generally frustrated that we're not appreciated. So it really would be good if the population of this country were to know all the...
I take your point, Tayaba.
But here's the question.
Yeah.
I keep on hearing from your guests about Spain should have waited for the diplomatic efforts to move in the right direction before withdrawing, etc. And I just don't understand, given our behavior and the lack of sincerity in the days leading up to the war to begin with, in pulling the United States, United Nations together, mm-hmm. for involving the United Nations. Why should any country have faith to stay with us and keep their troops there? Why not wait and see if the diplomatic effort, if there's genuineness there and the diplomatic effort actually works out, and then they may well send the troops back.
Okay, but perhaps even more specifically, Tab, if I take your question and push it a little bit further, Jeremy, to what extent has this administration been educated about the importance of the alliances? If we look back 18 months ago at the way that the president was speaking quite openly about going it alone, and the situation that the administration is in now in looking for assistance and partners to get this to the UN or to basically, you know, get it solved.
Yes, they've quite clearly learned something about multilateralism and something about the need for the international community in order to sustain a coalition and to sustain partnerships. And I suppose that's been a valuable, if hard-won, lesson. I think on the other side, though, to get to your caller's point, there is a lack of recognition, I think, for however we got into the Iraq war, that the current situation in Iraq is not just an American problem. It is a problem for the entire world, and it is particularly
A lack of recognition of this.
Yeah, there's a lack of recognition of this, particularly in Europe. There's the view that this is an American war, that we are either helping them or not helping them. But in fact, however we got into the war, the chaos in Iraq, an American failure in Iraq would be a disaster, certainly for the Europeans. And so there needs to be some stepping up to the plate by the Europeans to recognize that, and this is the kind of the flip side of multilateralism, to recognize that they have a responsibility in Iraq. Even if they weren't responsible for it getting that way, they have a responsibility just as leaders of the free world to help the situation, to try to move Iraq to a more stable place, because it's in their interest. The Americans may not succeed in doing it on their own.
Jeremy, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Jeremy Shapiro is Associate Director of the Brookings Institution Center on the United States and Europe. Earlier in the hour, we talked with Daniel Trotta, Reuters correspondent based in Madrid, Piero Benetazzo, a founder of Italy's daily paper La Repubblica, and Rob Gifford, National Public Radio's Beijing correspondent. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.